we begin, I want to quick set the stage for us of what's going on in this part of the Bible, in the life of Hosea, do a little political teaching as well as kind of what's going on religiously in the area. So just a quick reminder, Hosea is prophesying. He's living about 740 BC, 740 BCE, right? So remember, 1000 BC is when the King David was in power. And the nation of Israel was sort of at its pinnacle and its peak, right? He was a man after God's own heart. They were trying to follow God. Things were going well for them in so many different ways. They were united. That's 1000 BC. It did not last very long. 922 BC, the nation actually split in half. And so I'll show you a quick a map of that. What did they split over? This is going to sound very familiar, but it's basically power and taxes. You can see where Jerusalem is. The northern part of the kingdom didn't like what was going on in Jerusalem. They felt like there was too much power there. They weren't being represented enough. They were being taxed too much for what they were getting. Sound familiar? And so in 922, they actually split in half. The northern kingdom retained the name Israel. And they were centered in Samaria, which was the capital city. The southern kingdom became known as Judah and is centered, you see, in Jerusalem. Okay, so the northern kingdom is where this takes place. Hosea is a prophet to the northern kingdom. And you think about the northern kingdom, just look at the map. Excuse me. Very rural, kind of pastoral, lots of distance in between people, not as populated. And therefore, it was really a blend, not just of the people of Israel, but all these other nations that were there. Because remember, it wasn't just Israel. It wasn't just the Israelites that were there, but it was all the Canaanites, all the people from Cana that lived there as well. So it leads to this religious question for us. Second thing, so this is where it is. It's in that northern kingdom of Israel. The second thing we want to talk about is the actual religious climate of that northern nation of Israel right now. The people of Israel lived next to the Canaanites, right? Canaanites are people from Cana, just like Americans are people from in America, right? And they worshipped a ton of gods, right? For much longer than Israel had ever been there. One of those gods was this one, and we can see his picture or his image, and that's the god Baal. Baal wasn't the strongest god or the lead god in the pantheon of the ancient world, but it was in some ways the most important because Baal was the god of rain and of fertility. Okay, so think about it in that part of the world, right? This arid, dry, arid region. Rain, really important. And fertility, really important, right? In a world that is, in our world, it's your 401k and your stock options that will take you to the end. In that world, it was your kids that were going to be your retirement plan, right? So having children, important. Having children to protect boundaries and borders was important. And so you can imagine the importance of that. And so you can see how things like ritual prostitution came into play, right? Because all over northern Israel, as in a lot of other parts of Canaan, there were these little centers where people could come worship Baal through visiting these temple prostitutes. You can see how that is. It's almost, this is going to sound bad, but it was almost sacramental for them. Right, it was a way to enact what they were hoping from the god, Baal, right? So, and it was just very normal for the whole part of the world. It was just very, very normal. And in fact, so when Israel moves in, although God calls them to be different, you can only and only imagine that it starts to become just part of the air that people breathe. Okay, so that's the landscape. So now let's turn to our story of Hosea and Gomer. Let's look at Hosea chapter 1. This is, sort of sets the table at the beginning here. When the Lord began to speak through Hosea, the Lord said to him, remember this is enacted prophecy, go marry a promiscuous woman and have children with her, for like an adulterous wife, this land is guilty of unfaithfulness to the Lord. So he married Gomer, daughter of Diblaim, and she conceived and bore him a son. Okay, so let's look at this for a second. Let's look first at Gomer. Do you know what the name Gomer means in Hebrew? It means completion. Or maybe a better term is an excess experience. It's the full completion of what this experience is, the excess experience. That's what Gomer's name means. Remember in Hebrew, your name meant something. You were named into what your parents were hoping for you, right? So I think it's no coincidence then when you look at her father's name, which is Diblaim. Do you know what Diblaim means in Hebrew? I kid you not, this is true. It means double layer fig cake. Right? Not just figs, not just a cake, but a double layer fig cake. Can you imagine anything more fattening and like a dessert that is bad for you but good for you in the same turn? So I think it's no wonder then that this man, who's named Double Layer Fig Cake, right, who wants the fullness of experience and expression no matter what it costs, names his daughter Completion, or the excess experience. And so it's no wonder that we see this woman doing what she's doing, especially in the community and the culture that she experienced. That her name itself and his name itself meant that I'm willing to do things for myself that are going to make me feel good. That even though it makes me feel good, I don't care what it does to everyone around me. And so you can imagine then what might be happening here. And some scholars think that maybe Gomer, who is now married to this man Hosea, has been involved in maybe some of these ritual prostitution places, these temple prostitutes, kind of part of her fleshly experience of her faith. Maybe she was a person on site there. Maybe she was someone who took part in it. We don't know. But you can see how this happens, that sometimes people get into a place where they do things for themselves and for the experience, even though it's bad for themselves ultimately and for others as well. I think actually that's a great definition of lust. When we're talking about lust in the church, oftentimes what we talk about is it's just strictly sexual, and it certainly is that. But it's so much bigger than that. Lust is actually the pursuit of any immediate craving that is based solely on the self. Lust, if you think about it, is the pursuit of any immediate craving that is based solely on the self. Dante calls it disordered love. He calls lust disordered love. Good description, right? What is true love? God's love for us, agape love. Martin Luther King Jr. calls it disinterested love, right? Love that is given without interest expected in return. And that's really what lust is. It's disordered love. It's a love that is not about the other or good for the other. It's something that love that is just good for me. And the hard part is that it might not even be good for me. 10 cans of SpaghettiOs are not good for me. It might sound good, but it's not, right? It's any pursuit, any immediate craving that I pursue that is based solely on love for myself and not good for the other. And it comes in physical ways, as we know, but it also comes in so many other shapes, doesn't it? Let me give you an example. Put a picture up here. This is someone we might know from past. This is Henry David Thoreau. Probably many of us have read some of his books in our past. He's a transcendentalist, one of the famous transcendentalists. Remember what transcendentalism is from your U.S. history days, right? Transcendentalism is this belief in the pursuit of my human individual experience over and above the corrupt society, right? That's what the transcendental experience was. It was my pursuit of my individual experience over and above a corrupt society that would try to bring me down. So remember what Thoreau wrote. He wrote in this book, Walden, which probably many of us have read. I'm just going to read a little quote from that. He said, "I went to the woods because I wished to live deliberately." Remember, he went out to Walden's Pond for a year to live off the land. "To front only the essential facts of life and to see if I could not learn what it had to teach. And not when I came to die to discover that I had not lived." And then I'm going to skip down a little bit. "I wanted to live deep." This is the quote that we all remember. I wanted to live deep and suck all the marrow out of life. To live so sturdily and Spartan-like, which is good in Skyline Country, as to put to rout all those things that were not life. To cut a broad swath and shave close. To drive life into a corner and reduce it to its lowest terms. Beautiful. right? We want to do that. We want to get rid of all the noise, the cacophony of noise, and we want to just get down to the distillate of life and really focus on those things, right? And I don't know a single person who doesn't once in a while just want to go off the grid for a year and just check out and live maybe in the woods somewhere, right? But think about what's really going on here. This is a type of lust, isn't it? It is a lust of independence and experience. A lust that says, I don't care about my family, I'm just going to go off the grid for a year. I'm going to go in and see what I can do, right? And we lust for those sort of things, especially in Sammamish America, where we can pull it off. We have a lust for power over our affairs. We have a lust for independence. We have a lust for things that are good for us, right? This transcendental nature, I think, frankly, this is what drives America right now, right? This experiential, me-first society and experience of life over and above what it does for other people, right? We can lust after physical things, but we can lust after things not physical that lead to our spiritual demise and really lead to the demise of others as well. So what does that look like for you? This is the first question that I'd have for you and for me today. What do you hunger and crave in this world that's only good for you and maybe not good for those around you? Maybe it's a physical pursuit. Maybe it is something that has to do with our sexuality. Maybe it's something that has to do with our mind. Maybe it has something to do with winning at all costs. Maybe it has something to do with our work. I don't know what it is. But what is it that's good for you that is not good for others around you? Chances are that's something that we lust after, and it's something that leads us away from the place of God and not towards Him. But here's the good news. Here's the good news. God gives us an antidote for lust. And that antidote is His fidelity to us. God, through this life of Hosea, gives us a glimpse of what God looks like, what God's relationship with us looks like. In the midst of Gomer's selfishness, in the midst of our selfishness, in the midst of our own pursuits for pleasure and power, what does God do? God remains faithful to us. And that faithfulness changes us. The faithfulness itself can change us. Do you know what Hosea's name means? We heard what Gomer's name means, right? Her name is completion or full to the excess. Do you know what Hosea means? Hosea means the one who delivers, right? Hosea related to Yeshua, right? The Old Testament word that is Jesus' name, right? Joshua is the name for Jesus in the New Testament. God saves. That's what Hosea means. It's the one who delivers. And that's what happens in this story, right? Hosea, through his fidelity, delivers Gomer. He goes back out, and the scripture says he purchases her back. So maybe she went back to this temple cult, or maybe she was out, we don't know. But he redeems her and maintains his faithfulness to her, regardless of her actions. And friends, this isn't just the story of one man. Remember, this is a lived out prophecy. It really is the story of God and us, a God who redeems us, a God who comes into our world and pursues us in pleasure, in our pleasure and in our power for our own lustful gain, and says, you are worth more than that. And that belief that Jesus believes, that God believes in us, that we are worth more than that, it changes us. It gives us courage. It lets us know that God has a better life for us and encourages us to live in faithful ways. Because when someone believes in you, your life is changed. A few weeks ago, we celebrated the life of my father-in-law, Hugh Hoff, his memorial service. And it was so beautiful and it was so wonderful. But one of the most wonderful stories that was told there by all the children, but is really my favorite story of my father-in-law, has to do with this this phrase that he would say to his kids and then to his grandkids. And so if you ask his kids or his grandkids now, they will all repeat it. And it's this: when his kids would come to him when they were younger, and even now, and they had a problem. Maybe it's a relationship problem, or maybe it's. Something huge like what job should I take or something about my career, Hugh would always listen And he would always show empathy. But at the end, he would always say this phrase, "You're smart, you'll figure it out." It sounds like he's pushing it off, right? But he didn't. He was a great coach. He would give you advice. But ultimately, what he would say is, "Hey, I believe in you. You are so smart. You're going to figure this out. I can't wait for you to tell me." It was like love and logic before love and logic. It was fantastic. And here's the reality. His kids did that. And they do that. And his grandkids do that, did that, and do that. Right? There's a spirit of courage and confidence that comes because they knew that their dad and their granddad believed in them. He believed in them. And when they knew he believed in them, they felt like they could do it. They could stay away from the pitfalls and they could come back to what they were created to do. And friends, is that not true for us? I do not know a person in this world that doesn't struggle with some place of lust here and there. I mean, it's just absolutely true. Part of that might be animal instincts. Part of that might be our fallen human nature. But we do. We struggle with these things. But here's the beautiful truth of the gospel. God is faithful to us, and God is with us, and God believes in us. He believes that we can do it. And all we need to do is start to believe that he believes. Because when we do, when we start that, when we begin, we turn unsacred places into sacred ones. As we close, I want to read a prayer for us, and it's I'm going to put the book on. You're going to want to get this book. It's called Every Moment Holy, and it's by a guy named Douglas McKelvey, and I'll put a little link. It's actually on back order right now, so you have to wait. But basically, what it is a book of liturgies for everyday life. And so, for example, I'll give you a few of them. There's a prayer in there called the Ritual of the Morning Coffee. There's the liturgy before shopping and the liturgy before paying bills. There's even the liturgy of changing the diaper. So you get the picture, right? It's like every moment is a precious, holy, sacred moment. And what would it look like for us to give them over to both in the good times of life and in the times of struggle? And so what I want to do is I'm going to read one of these liturgies for us. We'll use this as our closing prayer. Called a liturgy for one battling a destructive desire. And that's essentially what we're doing, right? When we're battling lusts in our lives, it's something that is good for us. It's not good for us. It's not good for us. We are battling in it. We are in a struggle with it. And we have this privilege of having a God who believes in us, who comes alongside of us. So I'm going to read this for us. But before we do, I'm just going to give us a couple moments of silence. And here's what I'd like you to do. I'd love for you in faith, knowing that God is with you and hears you, to think about that place in you that is maybe your biggest place of lust in your life, right? Maybe it's the temptation and the lusts of what we see online. Maybe it's the temptation of power and privilege that we have at home. Maybe it's money, maybe it's winning. I don't know what it is for you. I don't know what it is for you. But bring it to mind, those things that you hunger for, those things that you crave, that you give into. And I want you to take them and just open your hands up to God and hear these words and pray these words in faith. For we have a God who delivers us and believes in us and will not let us go. And so I invite you for a few moments to be silent, and then we'll read this prayer as we close the message. Jesus, here I am again, desiring a thing that were I to indulge in it, would war against my own heart and the hearts of those I love. O Christ, rather let my life be thine. Take my desires, let them be subsumed in still greater desire for you, until there remains no room for these lesser cravings. In this moment, I might choose to indulge a fleeting hunger, or I might choose to love you more. Faced with this temptation, I would rather choose you, Jesus, but I am weak. So be my strength. I am shadowed be my light. I am selfish. Unmake me now and refashion my desires according to the better designs of your love. Given the choice of shame or glory, let me choose glory. Given the choice of this moment or eternity, let me choose in this moment what is eternal. Given the choice of this easy pleasure or the harder road of the cross, give me grace to choose to follow you, knowing that there is nowhere apart from your presence where I might find the peace I long for, no lasting satisfaction apart from your reclamation of my heart. Let me build then, my King, a beautiful thing by long obedience, by the steady progression of small choices that laid end to end will become like the stones of a pleasing path stretching to eternity unto your welcoming arms and unto the sound of your voice pronouncing the judgment, well done.